Hey everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. Welcome, this is podcast number 2 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I'm your host, my name is David, and thank you for joining me again this week. This week on Indirect Democracy, we'll be covering a look back at Katrina. It's been 1 year later. We're going to look back at the events of this past week to commemorate the horrible disaster that occurred on our Gulf Coast. We'll also be taking a look at global warming. We're going to have a word from our sponsor and, of course, have our What a Weenie Award. But as I was thinking about global warming, my fiance and I, Rachel, we got ourselves a brand new television recently. And why I bring this up about global warming is that I drove her pretty much nuts in trying to find not just a good TV, but a TV that was Energy Star compliant. And, you know, it was a little bit of an inconvenience in trying to find one that was, but we did end up finding a great TV at a good price and was compliant with Energy Star. So this got me thinking about global warming because there were some solutions that I forgot to mention last week, and I do apologize for that. I'm trying to keep the episodes down to 30 minutes, but that didn't work out, and let's see, this week's probably not going to work out as well, but I'm going to do my best in the future to try to keep them short. Talking about global warming again, some solutions that we didn't talk about. Of course, I did not talk about hybrid cars or biodiesel. If you are considering getting a hybrid car just because of its ability to reduce CO2 emissions, it's a great idea, and it is worth looking into. On the subject of biodiesel, if you happen to own a car that runs a diesel engine, there are conversion kits now that allow your car to run off of essentially what's cooking grease. It's called biodiesel. It's used by Willie Nelson uses it for his bus tour. I believe that the Dave Matthews Band uses it on theirs as well. And it's becoming a popular method to use cooking grease to fuel your car instead of using regular diesel fuel. Now, some people say that one of the drawbacks is that it emits the smell of food, French fries or sometimes Thai food, depending on who you turn to. But let's face facts. Your car probably already smells like French fries, so there's going to be no difference in the emissions and the smell. So you should think about it if you have one. And there is a link, if you're in the Southern California area, to lovecraftfuels.com. It's at the research page for Indirect Democracy. And I checked, and the conversion piece costs about $100, so it's worth taking some time looking into, giving some serious thought if you have a diesel car and want to reduce your carbon footprint out there in the world. Also in global warming news, our California State Assembly passed AB Bill 32, reducing the amount of greenhouse gases that the state should produce by the year, I believe, 2020, if I have that correct. The only thing I would suggest, if you're in California, is call Governor Schwarzenegger and tell him to sign this bill. You can call him at area code 916-445-2841, or you can email him at www.govmail.ca.gov. That's govmail, G-O-V-M-A-I-L, in case you're interested. But as I was mentioning, it's like the TV and everything else. There are small things that we can do every day, and I hope it's not trying to sound like I'm guilting you into it. But there are small things that we can do every day to reduce the amount of carbon emissions that we put out. At 70 million pounds every day that goes into the atmosphere, we can try to make even the smallest little efforts to change that. In other news, I didn't want to keep talking about global warming for too long. This came from Canyon News, and it's a story called Disconnected America. I'm going to quote this story. It seems like our military doesn't do anything for itself anymore. Food, maintenance, laundry, and even entertainment is subcontracted to for-profit companies. One of these companies, a subsidiary of Halliburton, recently contracted to send a troop of what used to be called go-go dancers to Iraq. These scantily clad women, chosen for their physiques, perform sexually suggestive dance routines while singing or lip-syncing to popular music. They don't remove all their clothing as part of their act, but they do everything else strippers do. Oh boy, if you think about all the things that we could be sending over to our armed forces, things like body armor, properly equipped Humvees, maybe more ground forces, if we're going to improve their morale, maybe a timeline to know when they're coming home, give them better benefits when they come home. even win over hearts and minds. What we've done, or at least allowed, is to send go-go dancers to a part of the world that makes women dress up from head to toe. So if we're trying to win hearts and minds, I don't think they're doing a pretty good job with that one. In fact, I think that's a pretty lousy job. But to anybody who's listening who knows somebody in the armed forces, this is not a smack at them. This is, God bless them all, come home safe and come home soon. And to Gus, godless U.S. soldier, if you're out there listening, I don't know if you are, but thanks for the inspiration and in creating this podcast, and wish you all the best. Come home soon, buddy. Let's see, in other news, I'm pretty sure we've all heard about this. The planet Pluto was demoted to a planetino. I'm not exactly sure what a planetino is, because it sounds like something that goes with your coffee at Starbucks. But it's now a planetino, or a dwarf planet. Now, this got me thinking about one particular little aspect, hopefully to give our president some new advice, some good advice. It got me thinking about President Ronald Reagan, which our president likes to model himself after. Now, if you're any type of a news hound like I am, President Reagan and his wife, Nancy, were big astrology buffs back in the 80s. In fact, it was known in the, I believe, throughout their presidency that they contacted an astrologist to help them with major decisions. So, with that in mind, I thought, well, that's a good idea. Maybe our president should start looking to the stars to get a better idea of how to run the country. So, I looked up his horoscope for this week. And since our president is a Cancer, and by Cancer I mean that's his astrological sign, and that he's a fast-spreading bat phenomenon. It's two meanings in one. It's a homonym. Nothing? No? Not even a titter? Woo! Tough podcast. Okay. Ah, here's your President Bush. Here is your horoscope for this week. This is your career horoscope from the pages of Elle magazine. Your meter reading is a 7. September 4th through the 10th. You're more conscious of the value of good timing. A deadline occurs that changes the course of events this week. Something that you've anticipated finally comes to pass. The event itself won't be a surprise, but your reaction to it and the aftermath may throw you a bit. Maybe it'll be less stressful or monumental than you'd anticipated. Regardless of your reaction, this week includes a defining moment that moves you in a different direction. Although a certain amount of adjustment is required, it's a good, healthy change. And your touchstones for this week are peridot and quartz crystal. And as I was reading that, I found myself going, what year is this? Now, this particular horoscope is for September 2006, but boy, that sounds like it could come out of September 2001 or last year. So, of course, that gets me thinking about last year. This is not to sound too morose. This particular podcast is going to be very clip-heavy. But it is important to remember the events that occurred last year in the Gulf Coast, and particularly some of the sounds that came out of there on that horrible, horrible week.
My mother was trapped in St. Bernard Nursing Home, and every day she called him and said, "Are you coming, son? Is somebody coming?" And she said, "Yeah, Mama, somebody's coming to get you. Somebody's coming to get you on Tuesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Wednesday. Somebody's coming to get you on Thursday. Somebody's coming to get you on Friday." And she drowned it Friday night. She drowned it Friday night.
Mr. President,
nobody's coming to get it. Nobody's coming to get it. The secretary has promised. Everybody's promised. They've had press conferences. I'm sick of the press conferences. For God's sakes, shut up and send us somebody.
I have a funeral is going on down here. They flew down here one time, 2 days after the doggone event was over, with TV cameras, all kind of goddamn, excuse my French, everybody in America. But I am pissed.
There's no earthly answer that anyone can understand why these people, after 6 days, are still in this filthy, miserable convention center. Why are they still here? There's the free...
One person criticizes them or says one more thing, including the President of the United States, he will hear from me. One more word about it after this show airs, and I might likely have to punch him, literally.
In putting this podcast together, I was trying to be as objective as possible because, as I mentioned, I'm trying to make this as a conversation between you and me to come up with constructive ideas on how to address every possible issue that ails our country, to find ways amongst each other when our government can't do things to fix our problems, to indirectly affect our democracy. But certain problems seem so huge and are so disproportionately, like I said, I'm trying not to use bad language, and I'm trying to keep certain things aside, but they're so disproportionately horrible that we have to put certain blame where it belongs. Katrina, 1 year later, is the commemoration is almost something that you feel ashamed about, because what is now existing in the Gulf Coast is a shame on our country. And here's a quote. This is from Newsweek for September 4, 2006. The story is called Orleans Blues. A year after the storm, New Orleans water and sewer pipes are still badly damaged, and the city has been unable to certify that the water is drinkable in much of the blighted but once tight-knit neighborhood known as the Lower Nine. From a story by Robert Lindsay, Katrina death toll plummets to 1723. On August 1st, that's this year, only a month ago, another body, or more correctly, a skeleton, was found after firefighters smashed down the door of a home filled with debris. Officials were alerted by a man who said his mother may still be in the home. There are still 135 people missing from the storm. That number has not changed in the past month or two. Although many missing continue to be found up until a few months ago, at this late date, I fear that many of the missing are probably dead. One wonders at what point the missing are simply assumed to be dead. In a serious case, a bureaucratic failure, the official missing list for Louisiana has not been updated since February 2nd, and still contains the names of 2,371 people. And also, this is from the Newsweek article I quoted earlier, the Gray Line Bus Company runs a Hurricane Katrina tour, which charges tourists $35 a day to look at some of the worst hit spots. This has been 1 year later, and there are tour buses. They're going by some of the worst hit spots. Debris has still not been cleaned up. Refrigerators still contain the same items inside that they had on August 29th, 2005. They are still finding bodies inside the homes of people that died in the Gulf Coast. These weren't bodies that were swept out into the ocean. These weren't bodies that are somehow missing within wooded areas. These are bodies with inside people's homes. We have failed our fellow Americans. Our government, state, local, and especially federal, has failed the Gulf Coast. Now, I know it's not a popular thing to say that the state and local, especially if you're a liberal, failed the people, but we have to be honest about this, and that yes, state and local did fail. The warning to evacuate came a day late. That's not me, that's the select committee that investigated the hurricane, the response to Hurricane Katrina. Now, I know that some people will state that it's part of Louisiana culture, maybe New Orleans culture, to try to stick things out. That's part of their mindset not to leave, and I don't mean that in a bad way, so if you're listening, don't think it's that I'm saying that, oh no, they wanted to stay and they wanted, you know, to suffer the way they did. That isn't the point. It's what a lot of critics are saying, but I'm going to play a clip from what was recently done on Nightline, and it involves people that had to leave for Ernesto.
We ran into people who were surprised by the intensity of Ernesto.
We started out this morning in Charleston, South Carolina.
The first bands of rain have begun to come ashore, and this city is hunkering down.
Charleston is a low-lying city, prone to flooding. But this morning, few people in the area seem to be taking the storm seriously.
Ernesto's welcome to come over for dinner. We're having crabs and we got the Bloody Mary mix. We're going to have a great time.
We want to be prepared, but we also don't want it to interfere with our vacation.
Like I said, if we're going to be honest with each other about this, it's time to be honest about that particular mindset that comes across. You cannot criticize the people of Katrina who could not leave if you are not going to criticize people of Carolina who chose to stay around for Ernesto to have a party, if you will, to not ruin their vacations. Nobody in the media, nobody in any type of atmosphere has come across to criticize people that stayed in the Carolinas. But there's one huge difference. One thing that I did not get across is that many of the people that stayed in Louisiana, New Orleans, were people who were so poor that they exist below the poverty line. These are people who do not have the means or the resources to leave. They don't have SUVs. They don't have plane money, train money, bus money to leave that area. Everything that they had in the entire world was within that city. Anything that they could have, including their jobs. Some of them were told that they'd be fired if they left. What do you do when everything you have is in one place and you don't even have the resources to leave it? You stay, you pray, and you hope. And then when that doesn't work, you pray and hope that the people who you give the charge to, that we indirectly elect to represent us, will come through and rescue them. That is not something that should be unimagined in our country. It should be what happened, but it didn't. Now, I was talking about state and local, and as I mentioned, where the state and local really, really failed. We talked about evacuation orders, and one major place was, and this comes from the city of New Orleans, in designating the Superdome as a place of congregation, a final last resort. Well, nobody even knows if that building was set up to handle that particular type of hurricane, and we all saw that it wasn't. Nor did it have the resources to handle that many people left in the city. So on there they failed. But after that, the disaster was so overwhelming that this is where our federal government failed the people of the Gulf Coast.
I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
Sunday morning, I opened newspapers and saw headlines that said, New Orleans dodged the bullet.
Every person in that convention center, we just learned about that today. And so I have directed that we have all available resources to get to that convention center to make sure that they have the food and water, the medical care that they need.
Sir, you're not telling me.
Those bodies that are there.
Sir, you're not telling me you just learned that the folks at the convention center didn't have food and water until today, are you? You had no idea they were completely cut off?
Paula, the federal government did not even know about the convention center people until today.
And so many of the people in the arenas here, you know, were underprivileged anyway. This is working very well for them.
This is from a news story that appeared on the Jim Lehrer NewsHour. It's called FEMA Faces Intense Scrutiny. FEMA defers to state and local emergency teams to handle disasters at their level. If a city cannot respond, the county or state provides help. If the state lacks resources, the federal government responds, but only at the request of the governor and on the recommendation of the region's FEMA director. In order to tap into FEMA resources, the state's governor must submit a letter to the president requesting to formally invoke the Robert T. Stafford Disaster Relief and Emergency Act. In the letter, the governor estimates what resources would be necessary to assist state and local crews responding to the situation. As Katrina threatened the Gulf Coast, Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco issued a state of emergency on August 26th, and on August 28th sent a letter to President Bush requesting a disaster declaration for the state in order to release federal assistance. That's one day before the hurricane hit. I have determined, and this is a quote from her letter, I have determined that this incident will be of such severity and magnitude that effective response will be beyond the capabilities of state and affected local governments, and that supplementary federal assistance will be necessary, Blanco wrote in her letter. The letter had to travel through points in FEMA before the federal government could respond. FEMA deployed regional responders before Katrina made landfall, but a major federal response wasn't evident until days later. The hurricane crippled many state and local emergency agencies in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, leaving them unable to respond without federal help. Point being, our government was informed. And on the White House's own website, they issued an emergency declaration on August 27, 2005 that reads as follows. The President today declared an emergency exists in the state of Louisiana and ordered federal aid to supplement state and local response efforts in the parishes located in the path of Hurricane Katrina beginning on August 26, 2005 and continuing. Specifically, FEMA is authorized to identify, mobilize, and provide at its discretion equipment and resources necessary to alleviate the impacts of the emergency. Debris removal and emergency protective measures, including direct federal assistance, will be provided at 75% federal funding. What is shocking, if you read that, and I'll have the link up, is that missing from all the counties that are listed on this particular declaration, two of those parishes, and these were not the ones who were set aside. Like I said, I'm trying to keep my cool on this one. Included Orleans Parish and St. Bernard's Parish. All the inland parishes were set aside in the emergency declaration. And there's a map up on the Potomatic site that shows in red which parishes were set aside for emergency disaster relief. And none of them include the coastal counties. To quote from that picture, if that's not incompetence, what is? Our president was warned about this disaster. It was coming 3 days earlier from space, a disaster that everybody can see. Here's what our president knew.
Bush was dialed into that briefing from his ranch in Crawford, Texas, and offers support for the ongoing efforts.
I want to assure the folks at the state level that we are fully prepared to not only help you during the storm, but we will move in whatever resources and assets we have at our disposal after the storm to help you deal with the loss of property, and we pray for no loss of life, of course.
But the president doesn't ask any questions, and just 4 days later tells ABC News that no one could have predicted the scope of this storm.
There is frustration, but I want people to know there's a lot of help coming. I don't think anybody anticipated the breach of the levees.
A seemingly direct contradiction to what is said at the briefing.
I don't think anyone can tell you with any confidence right now whether the levees will be topped or not, but that's obviously a very, very big concern.
The select committee that did the report on the response to Hurricane Katrina had one particular quote which was stunning. They said that this disaster relief lacked imagination, and that the same lack of imagination was the same type that was found before 9/11. Included within the Select Committee report was that critical elements of the National Response Plan were executed late, ineffectively, or not at all. Although the military played an invaluable role, coordination was lacking. There was a lack of National Guard. The failure of initiative, was also a failure of empathy, a myopia to the need to reach more people on their own terms. I'm not sure, I can't remember, isn't the president commander-in-chief of our armed forces? So although our military played an invaluable role, coordination was lacking. Lack of National Guard. Louisiana National Guard at the time, a good majority of them, were in Iraq. Despite your belief as to right or wrong, the war in Iraq, to have Louisiana National Guardsmen, people who are trained to protect and defend the state of Louisiana in that particular type of emergency, to not have them home or on the first transport out to come back home is shocking. And to have high water vehicles that are suited to handle that type of emergency in Louisiana, to have them in Iraq, in the middle of the desert, makes no sense whatsoever. But as I said, none of this should be surprising, because we now know that the president was informed, but he was informed late. Here's an article from Newsweek as well. This is dated September 19th, 2005. The article is entitled, Katrina, How Bush Blew It. It's a standing joke among the president's top aides. Who gets to deliver the bad news? Warm and hearty in public, Bush can be cold and snappish in private, and aides sometimes cringe before the displeasure of the president. Tuesday, the bad news on this early morning, Tuesday, August 30th, or some 24 hours after Katrina had ripped through New Orleans, was that President Bush would have to cut short his five-week vacation by a couple of days and return to Washington. The president's chief of staff, Andrew Card, his deputy chief of staff, Joe Hagan, his counselor, Dan Bartlett, and his spokesman, Scott McClellan, held a conference call to discuss the question of the president's early return and the delicate task of telling him. Hagan, it was decided, as senior aide on the ground, would do the deed. The president did not growl this time. He had already decided to return to Washington and hold a meeting of his top advisors on the following day, Wednesday. This would give them a day to get back from their vacations and their staffs to work up some ideas about what to do in the aftermath of the storm. President Bush knew the storm and its consequences had been bad, but he didn't quite realize how bad. Now, one of the stunning things that comes across to me at this is that they wanted to give people an extra day to get back from vacation. What? Doesn't anybody have a cell phone? Computers? Conference calls? Nobody knows how to dial a phone? It takes them a day to come back and think of ideas? And it's stunning. What's amazing to me is that the president still stayed on vacation. This is Wednesday. The vice president was still on vacation in Wyoming, and the secretary of state, Condoleezza Rice, was in New York shopping. I'm going to continue quoting from the article. The reality, say several aides who did not wish to be quoted because it might displease the president, did not sink in until Thursday night. In case you're trying to catch up or try to remember, the storm hit on Monday. Some White House staffers were watching the evening news and thought that the president needed to see the horrific reports coming out of New Orleans. Counselor Bartlett made up a DVD of the newscast so Bush could see them in their entirety as he flew down to the Gulf Coast and the next morning on Air Force One. Our president is supposed to have total situational awareness in the event of emergencies, and his awareness did not come until Thursday when he saw news reports on a DVD. The entire world was made aware of what was going on a constant stream through every cable news channel and national news channel throughout this entire United States. The world knew what was going on, but our president did not. Now, I'm going to keep on saying that. He is our president. Leftist, rightist, and I know I'm not pronouncing that correctly, lefty, righty, liberal, conservative, independent, I don't care what you are, this man is our president. I didn't vote for him. But it still doesn't change the fact that he is my president. And my president, your president, our president, failed. He failed at the one job that he has, the one job he claims most important, which is to protect the American people, and he did not because he did not make himself aware of what was occurring. And that is a shame on you, Mr. Bush. Oh, like I said, trying not to get myself too riled up about this, but it's almost an impossible thing not to be. Oh. Now, as I mentioned before, if we're talking about people that had lack of situational awareness or people who were even unqualified for the job, I cannot let this go by without talking about Michael Brown. Now, as I said, if you're a news hound, you probably know this, but I know a lot of people may be hearing information like this for the first time. Michael Brown was clearly unqualified for the job and that his previous position was that as the director of the Arabian Horse Association. And lately, Michael Brown has been on every news channel he can get onto. And here's a clip of him on This Week with George Stephanopoulos.
There was a complete breakdown of government at every level, federal, state, and local. The locals weren't ready. The state was overwhelmed, and the feds, for some reason, and I think primarily because we didn't ask.
And how about you?
Well, of course I failed, because I made many mistakes. The biggest mistake I've said that I made was not standing up and saying at the beginning of the storm, it's catastrophic, I can't get what I need, and this isn't working.
Your boss.
In Florida in 2004, we were everywhere we needed to be. You can't run a disaster sitting in an office somewhere.
But why didn't you get the buses
there? Which is what Chertoff wanted me to do. The buses is a separate issue. That shows the bureaucracy that exists within DHS. Prior to FEMA going to DHS, if you were my procurement officer, I would look at you and say, George, I need 500 buses. I don't care what they cost. Get them. In the DHS model, I turn to you and say, George, I'll cover your rear end if you get me the buses, no matter what they cost. But you now have to go to the DHS procurement officer, who then goes to the Undersecretary for Management, who then goes to the Secretary of Homeland Security, who then might go to the Secretary of Transportation. Those buses fell into a bureaucratic black hole, which is unacceptable. DHS is too big, and FEMA shouldn't be in it.
Now, there are several points that he brings up, but the one that I need to bring up immediately is that Michael Brown is basically trying to rehabilitate his image as the scapegoat and the one guy that shouldn't be blamed for anything. Well, Mr. Brown, you were in charge. You are at fault. And to people who go around thinking, oh, well, Brownie's not so bad now, you are wrong. He is at fault. He was the head of FEMA. It was his job to be in charge and take care of that situation, and he failed. To go around and say that, well, he was just a scapegoat, relieves that man of any responsibility, and we shouldn't allow that. Anybody who brings it up, remind them that he was in charge. This man should not be held unaccountable. Now, one other thing that I found particularly interesting is that he talks about the fact that FEMA should be out of the Department of Homeland Security, and I absolutely agree with him on this particular point. FEMA should not be part of DHS. DHS' job is Homeland Security. It's to take care of matters that deal with the homeland, hopefully before an incident, to make sure that nothing occurs to the homeland before it happens. Not a bad thing. But if we're talking about FEMA, their job is to handle a disaster after it's occurred, to help coordinate and rehab that area. And this is where FEMA does not belong in the DHS. It should be back where it belongs, as a cabinet-level position. So he is right about one thing, but there is something that I found particularly interesting during that interview. Michael Brown mentions that in Florida in 2004, he was able to get whatever resources he needed. This, and the inference that he makes is that it's because FEMA was not part of DHS. Now, this is from FEMA's own website, which states that on March 1st, 2003, FEMA became part of the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. March of 2003, FEMA was already part of DHS. So in 2004, Mr. Brown, if you were able to get everything that you needed to recover from a hurricane in Florida, how come you weren't able to do that in Louisiana in 2005? Is it because it was Florida during an election year? Was that the reason? Is it because it was Florida and class issues came up? Or was it because in Louisiana in 2005, you just failed? Probably the first two reasons have more. The third reason is just as big. In fact, I'll take all of the above. Let's see, what I'm going to do is, it may sound like I'm about to step ahead of myself, but I'm going to read you this one article. It's from MSNBC, dated February 27th, 2006. This is a series of previously unreleased emails. At 9 p.m. on Monday, August 29th, 2005, as Katrina swamped New Orleans, FEMA Director Michael Brown appeared on Larry King Live and announced, "This is a catastrophic disaster. We've got some storm surges that have come across the levees." Less than an hour later, at 9:51, Brown received an email from White House Chief of Staff Andy Card, who told him he had been kept well informed about your reports. "Anything you want me to do?" Brown replied, "Thanks for writing, Andy. This is a bad one. Housing, transportation, and environment could be long-term issues." I bring that up as a point as to continue with what the government knew. This is Michael Chertoff and what he claims he knew on Monday, August 29th, going into the 30th.
You have to listen to what I said. What I said was, not that we didn't anticipate that there's a possibility these levees will break. What I said is, in this storm, what happened is, the storm passed and passed without the levees breaking on Monday. Tuesday morning, I opened newspapers and saw headlines that said, "New Orleans dodged the bullet." What surprised people What surprised them was that the levee broke overnight and the next day, and in fact collapsed. That was a surprise. As to the larger point, there's no question that people have known for probably decades that New Orleans sits in a bowl surrounded by levees. This is a city built on the coast in an area that has hurricanes in it, that is built below sea levels, and that is a soup bowl.
What's particularly stunning about that clip is that Mr. Chertoff has just stated, he has admitted, that he, as the person in charge of our national security, in charge of DHS, had no situational awareness about what was occurring. If you remember from what I read just a few minutes ago from Michael Brown, at 9:51, he had contacted Andy Card on the 29th to let him know that water was overtopping the levees. Now, here's information from the Newsweek article I mentioned earlier from September 19th. And I quote, "As Katrina howled outside Monday morning and the windows of the Hyatt Hotel where the mayor had set up his command post began popping out, Nagin and his staff lay on the floor. Then came eerie silence. Councilperson Cynthia Morrell decided to go look at her district, including nearby Gentilly. Outside Canal Street was dry. Morrell told her driver that was close. But then, from the elevated highway, she began seeing neighborhoods under 8 to 15 feet of water. Holy God, she thought to herself. Then she spotted her first dead body. At dusk, on the 9th floor of City Hall, the mayor and the city council had their first encounter with the federal government. A man in a blue FEMA windbreaker arrived to brief them on his helicopter flyover of the city. He seemed unfamiliar with the geography, but he did have a sense of urgency. Water as far as the eye can see. It was worse than Andrew in 92 and Camille in 69. I need to call Washington, he said. Do you have a conference call line? According to an aide to the mayor, he seemed a little taken back when the answer was no. Long neglected in the city budget, communications within New Orleans city government were poor and eventually almost non-existent. The FEMA man found a phone, but he had trouble reaching senior officials in Washington. When he finally got somebody on the line, the city officials kept hearing him say, you don't understand. You don't understand. Governor Blanco, a motherly but steely figure known as the nickname of Queen Bee, knew she needed help, but she wasn't quite sure. At 8 p.m., she spoke to President Bush. Mr. President, we need your help. We need everything you've got. On the 29th, it was more than apparent that the city of New Orleans had been flooded. And yet, the Department of Homeland Security's chief, Michael Chertoff, just admitted that he didn't know that, and how he found out was from a newspaper that didn't even exist. There is no major paper in the country that had the headline, New Orleans Dodged a Bullet. The man lied. Our department chief, the guy in charge of our Homeland Security, openly admitted that not only did he not keep himself informed until he read a newspaper on Tuesday morning, he lied about what he read. The simple fact of the matter is that Mr. Chertoff should resign. Now, as I mentioned before, this is looking back at some of the events that happened this past week. Here's President Bush visiting the affected areas.
I come back to say that we will stand with the people of southern Louisiana and southern Mississippi until the job is done.
The job is far from done. Look around New Orleans, talk to the people, and you find a city still mired in wreckage, still uncertain of its future, still looking for leadership, energy, and direction.
I mean, we don't have street signs and stuff, and we just need somebody to lead us, you know, some kind of plan. Assure us that the levees are going to be good, the infrastructure is going to be here, you know.
Right now you don't have that. No leadership.
I don't see it.
It's a different story elsewhere. The federal government has spent an astonishing $110 billion plus on New Orleans and the Gulf Coast after Katrina. Hard to see where all that money went in many areas. But as governments dawdle and systems bog down,
I just want to welcome you all.
People are taking action on their own.
This facility just shows you. We did this in 3 months. Right. Why can't the government do what they need to do?
And what's then the answer to that?
There's no political will.
no political will, because there's no imagination. Now, the one thing that stood out to me in looking up as much information is that the government basically has a pre-Katrina mindset. And I mentioned this in several fashions. First, they're fixing the levees to pre-Katrina standards. The levees in New Orleans are being fixed to withstand a Hurricane 3, a Category 3 type hurricane. This is not going to be the case anymore. If you were here for the first podcast and we talked about global warming, the amount, because of the temperature increase, the strength of hurricanes just seems to intensify even more. And to fix levees to withstand the type of hurricanes that existed or would hit, you know, before Katrina, well, that's a pre-Katrina mindset. So it's time to fix those things to a better type of standard. Because, as I mentioned, the government's doing this. Also in Newsweek for September 4th, there was an article called "It's Cheaper to Go Dutch." The Netherlands is expert at keeping itself dry, so why aren't U.S. bureaucrats seeking more of its help rebuilding the levees? Okay, and I quote, Hans Wierling, I know I'm massacring that man's name, a renowned authority on flood control who designed part of the Dutch system, says it should be possible to protect New Orleans, even low-lying sections, from storm surges more than 10 times Katrina's. The price tag, less than $10 billion. Instead, Congress has so far allocated $5.7 billion to repair and rebuild the existing levees to pre-Katrina standards. Congress has given the Army Corps of Engineers $20 million to come up with a comprehensive design to protect the city permanently. American engineers have been in consultation with Dutch designers, and in the meantime, the Corps has asked a Dutch firm to design a 100 to 200 year floodgate system. Viljoen, for one, can't understand what the Corps is going to study for so long. Oh, well, the Corps has until 2007 to complete its study. Viljoen, for one, can't understand what the Corps is going to study for so long. The technology already exists and has been tested over decades in the Netherlands. He says Dutch and American engineers working together would need only a couple of months to draw up a detailed plan. If we had the will and 1 month's money from Iraq, we could do all the levees and restore the coast. Ivor van Heerden, a Louisiana State University hurricane scientist who warned for years about a Katrina-like disaster, says we can save Louisiana. It's very doable. This is all about political will. It's all about willing to go outside and, you know, for lack of a better term, think outside the box to take care of each other. And if those ideas have to come from outside the country, then do it. Because it's not your idea, it doesn't mean it's a bad idea. It's time to take care of each other and do everything that we can to take care of each other. Now, one particular thing I found fascinating from that Nightline clip, is that they mentioned that $110 billion has been spent. Well, that's not the truth. $110 billion has been allocated. Allocated is not spent. Here's an article from the Indianapolis Star. It's called "Gulf Exists Between Katrina Aid Allotted and Spent." Despite four emergency spending bills passed by Congress to provide more than $110 billion in aid, federal agencies have spent only $44 billion. Even as President Bush insisted that last week that $110 billion is a strong commitment, he conceded that the recovery effort was plagued with bureaucratic hurdles. In July, the GAO, or Government Accountability Office, reported that disbursement of Small Business Administration recovery loans was marred by significant delays. It's not only that we don't know what's been spent, we haven't even had an accurate description of what spent means, said Rob Neighbors, Democratic staff director for the House Appropriations Committee. They talk about commitments and obligations. They've invented new terms for not spending money. It's important to remember that when people talk about that with you, that the $110 billion is money that has been allotted or allocated. That does not mean money that has been actually spent. And it is time to get that money to the people who need it. And the president, Congress, local, state, need to get on it and get them to get that money. Because if they're expecting private enterprise or private individuals to do everything, they are asking way too much. Private enterprise is going to be very wary. Wow, that really was a bad choice of words, very wary. they're going to be less inclined to protect areas that are prone to flooding and stand way too much of a financial risk. We can only pray and hope that there are people that will come together to do so and are willing to take that chance. But it's asking too much if those levees and those ways to protect the city and the entire Gulf Coast are not done. And one other piece of information that I found just particularly stunning, and I'm going to end this particular look back at Katrina, is, and when I talk about pre-Katrina mindset, I'm also going back to way back in time, but this is from September 9, 2005. Bush suspends Pay Act in areas hit by storm. The Davis-Bacon Act, passed in 1931 during the Great Depression, sets a minimum pay scale for workers on federal contracts by requiring contractors to pay the prevailing or average pay in the region, and the president suspended that to pay people back in time for what they had. How do you expect people to live, to get by and rebuild when they have not even minimum wage to do it? That is what is meant by a pre-Katrina mindset. Pay people less than what they should be making nowadays and repair their city before the hurricane hit, and as if another one will never hit again. There is a serious lack of imagination and political will, and we need to hold our government accountable. It was once said that government is not eloquent. Government is like a force. It's like fire. It's a fearful servant and a powerful master, and it should not be held to irresponsible actions. The person who said that was George Washington, and we should not hold our government irresponsible. We need to hold them accountable for everything that they've done. So if you're in that area and you have the chance, vote them out. During these midterm elections, if there are government officials that did what they could to keep money from the affected areas, vote them out. Do what you can to get these people out of office. They don't belong there. They are not looking out for the interests of our country and our people. There will be a link up as to how to contact your congressperson, and I highly suggest that you never forget what happened last year. If you can, give to Habitat for Humanity or the American Red Cross. If you're not sure how to set aside money, The Randy Roach Show has a great link called Change for Change. It's called keeping your pocket change, amassing it over the year, and then sending it to Habitat for Humanity to rebuild homes in the Gulf Coast. But mostly, and I can't stress this enough, never forget what happened that day. Any emails, stories, comments that you get about Katrina, well, make sure that they're real for the first part. But never stop the conversation about Katrina, because we should never forget what happened that week. Okay, we're going to go on to a lighter note and finish up the show. I didn't take a break during it because I felt it was too much important to say, but we do have a word from our sponsor, and here it is.
I come back to say,
different connectivity. You'd have to say to yourself, this is in fact World War III.
World War III, right?
This is World War III.
World War III.
The start of World War III.
More like World War IV.
Okay, started the wrong clip, but here is what needs to be said, and I hope I don't get fired by this particular sponsor. Here we go.
World War III. It's coming. It may be next week, next year, or just before the election. You've heard the hype. Now, get the merchandise. Get them now. Your World War III coffee mugs, t-shirts, car flags, ball caps, shot glasses, mouse pads, golf balls, rubber wristbands, sports drink, video games, souvenir plates, special collector edition magazines, cigars, beer cozy, and big foam fingers. All high-quality items printed with the official World War III insignia and include a certificate of authenticity. Show your patriotism now. Buy all these items now. If you don't, the terrorists will win. And when you buy them, watch your investment grow along with your patriotism. This message brought to you by eBay. eBay. Because Americans will buy anything.
Well, started off with the wrong clip, but I think that ad went well. Well, last but not least, we're going to give out our What a Weenie Award for this week. This week's What a Weenie Award goes to Bill O'Reilly. Now, I may be a month late in getting to the story, but I just found out about it. Here it is. On July 26, 2006, an 18-year-old named Jennifer Moore was raped and murdered in New York. The details are that after spending the evening at a nightclub, she was separated from her friend, and her body was found in a garbage bin. On August 2nd, 2006, Bill O'Reilly had this to say. O'Reilly: "So anyway, these two girls come in from the suburbs and they get bombed. And their car is towed because they're moronic girls. And, you know, they don't have a car. So they're standing there in the middle of the night with no car. And then they separate because they're drunk. They separate, which you never do, all right? Now Moore, Jennifer Moore, 18 on her way to college. She was 5'2", 105 pounds, wearing a miniskirt and a halter top with a bare midriff. Now again, there you go. So every predator in the world is going to pick that up at 2 in the morning. You know, I should have no sense of surprise that Mr. O'Reilly would feel this way, but my anger on this particular issue is overwhelming. This kind of mentality that places the blame on the victim, the she asked for it, look at the way she was dressed mindset, is the kind of thinking that comes from an archaic and misogynistic fool who sees women as objects and not as individuals. No shock there, since Mr. O'Reilly has been accused before of using his power as an employer over his female subordinates to engage in sexual acts involving loofahs and falafel. He may have even boasted about cheating on his wife while out of the country in Europe, if the sexual harassment complaint against him is correct. Being a sexist, egotistical, lying, hypocritical bigot is one thing, but heading a major radio show that espouses this kind of lunacy is another. Women have the right to say no. Being dressed in any manner does not give any man the right to rape a woman. But not so for people that think like Bill O'Reilly. But that's only part of the problem. The real danger in Mr. O'Reilly's thought is that he's saying that this way of thinking, this set of beliefs, is okay. That his listeners should believe it's okay as well. Well, it's far from okay. And if Mr. O'Reilly wanted to see how wrong he is, he should try to be man enough to say that to the faces of Jennifer Moore's parents. Say it to her friends, her family. Say it about anyone you love, Mr. O'Reilly, whose body would be found in a dumpster like so much trash. If that happened to anyone you love, you would put the real blame where it belongs, on the killer. Most reasonable people see your show as entertainment, mindless, useless entertainment. I am sure in some places in the world, it's used to shoo rodents away. But last month, you turned it into an attack on a woman who had her whole life ahead of her, because you saw her as an object, not a person. Thanks for showing us all your true colors. Put me on that infamous list of yours, because you, sir, are a weenie, and I want the world to know it." Well, that's going to be it for this week. I apologize for the length of this particular podcast. Do look forward to hoping to see you next week. We're going to take a look back at September 11th, mostly the hunt for Bin Laden. But thank you again for listening. The music for this podcast is brought to you by Megaphone. The song is called Not Your Enemy. It's from the album For Crying Out Loud. You can find their music at www.megaphonemusic.net or at myspace.com/megaphone. Once again, thank you for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. And look forward to seeing you next week. Bye. A homonym.